She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Persisted the Nazi podcast. My name is Beatrice and I'm here with
Heather
and Elizabeth.
And in our, I don't know, it's like the fourth installment of a witch series, I think. Did I count correctly?
I think so.
The fourth installment.
Maybe five.
Fifth.
Five by this point.
Yes, five. There's
an interview in there.
We are very confused. Okay, so it's the fifth. We've also been recording for a while today, so don't be surprised if I am very... If what I'm saying is very chaotic. So, the last time we talked about European folklore, which is a few weeks ago, we had a very heavy focus on German folklore and, you know, the Grimm's kind of folklore and how this made its way into American culture, in brackets, Disney. But we only briefly touched upon a Eurasian figure, and that was the Baba Yaga. Liz talked about it. So if you haven't listened to that, go back to the beginning of a witches series and listen your way through to this series, because this is kind of the basis also of what we're going to talk about today. So now I would like to talk about a few more Eurasian characters. And the reason why I decided to do that was that Jenny, who is a friend of mine and my flatmate, is from the Ukraine. And I talked to her yesterday about witches, and I told her that we are going to record another witches episode. And she told me a lot about Ukrainian and Russian witch figures. And I found that very interesting. So today I'm kind of focused on a few Russian and Ukrainian and Slavic kind of figures. So, first of all, the Baba Yaga. We already talked about her. Liz said that she's the witch that lures people into the hut to eat them, but she also helps travelers. And then one aspect that Jenny told me about yesterday is that she has a very special house, which has no basement, but yes, it's kind of on two chicken legs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it can turn around when she does not want to have listeners. When she doesn't want to have visitors, she can turn around. So, AKA
the
when
she turns around?
Yeah. AKA uh-oh, when...
Yeah, so the little feet like do-do-do-do turns around so you can't
she
see can the
door. Turn around when she doesn't want to have visitors, AKA when she's not hungry.
So you should be relieved if you pass a hut on chicken legs and there's no door.
Oh, maybe.
Yes.
Because she's full for the moment.
She has eaten enough. She doesn't want any more flesh. Okay, so like we discussed in the last European episode, she's also a very morally ambiguous character because she's both a donor and a helper, but also a villain. She helps people, but she eats them. So, yeah, I think that's what you can call ambiguity. And Andreas Johns, who researches Slavic folklore, stated that she is, quote unquote, one of the most memorable and distinctive figures in Slavic European folklore, unquote. And he also said that she is enigmatic and often exhibits striking ambiguity. And he summarized Baba Yaga as, quote, a many-faceted figure capable of inspiring researchers to see her as a cloud, moon, death, winter snake, bird, pelican, mermaid, or earth goddess, totemic matriarchal ancestress, female initiator, phallic mother, or archetypal image, unquote. Which is maybe true for a lot of, you know, a lot of those powerful spiritual female characters. I feel like they're often very ambiguous. And then what's interesting with something that Jenny told me about yesterday is that Baba Yaga also has a companion. And I'm also going to butcher this name. He's called Koshai. Koshai Nems Merkni. Oh my god, I'm so sorry.
Oh, geez. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, Koshai means bones, and Kosh, the other word, means deathless or he who cannot die. So he's a sorcerer and he's very old. He basically looks like a sack of bones. This is why he's called Bones. And he cannot be killed. And he cannot be killed by his body being targeted, like human beings can be killed. He can only die when his soul is targeted. And his soul is not within his body, which makes killing him much harder. It's hidden inside a needle, and the needle is in an egg, and the egg is in a duck, and the duck is in a rabbit. And the rabbit is within...
Of course.
I mean...
This is like the nesting dolls. Just one.
Yeah, 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 yeah. The Russian dolls, right? Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. The needle is in an egg, the egg is in a duck, the duck is in a rabbit. The rabbit is in an iron or crystal or golden, depending on the tail, chest. The chest is buried under a green oak tree, and the green oak tree is on the island of Bayan in the ocean. If the chest is dug up and opened, the rabbit will run away. If the rabbit is killed, the duck will fly away. And if someone kills the duck and possesses the egg, they have power over Koshai. And one thing that they then can do is when they kind of turn the egg around, Koshai will also kind of flip around. So they have control over him. And if he get, and then if someone has the egg, he gets weaker, he gets sick, he loses his magic. And if the needle is broken, he finally dies. So that's something I found interesting, that Baba Yaga has a male companion. And that's also something that is the case for the second witch figure I'm going to talk about, which is the Kikimora. There are two different types of Kikimora. There's one that comes from the forest, and she's married to the Domovoi. I'm going to say a few words about him too later on. And then there's one that comes from the swamp, and she's married to Leshi. So both have male companions. And the one that comes from the swamp is identified by her wet footprints that she leaves in the house, because she's also kind of usually depicted as a female house spirit, a very malevolent female house spirit, nonetheless, but a female house spirit. So, yeah, she's a very bad, malevolent creature, while the Domovoi, the male spirit that she's kind of married, quote-unquote, to, or that is her partner, is a good house spirit. He's also male, and Domovoi means he from the house. So he's the one that protects houses and stuff like that. And both are very often juxtaposed and depicted as a couple. So he is benevolent, she is malevolent, which is also, again, very interesting. When the Kikimora possesses a house or inhabits a house, she lives behind the stoves of houses or in the basement. And what she does is that she lights fires, she starts stoves and places her lids and pots on the stoves to cook her own food. And she also starts electronical devices. When a house is in order, she is kind of a nice figure, because then she cares for the chickens, she looks after the chickens and the housework. And if the house is not tidy enough for her, then she gets very... let's just say, less nice and very uncomfortable. So there is a very likely etymological connection between the Mora in Kikimora and the Mare in Nightmare. So those are very likely connected. So Mora is a dark spirit from ancient Slavic mythology, and she takes on the form of, very surprisingly, a beautiful young woman. And then she visits men in her dreams, and she tortures them, quote unquote, with desire, whatever that means. And then she drags the life out of them. Kikimora also enters the room through keyholes. She sits on the chests of sleepers, which is something that, Liz, you talked about earlier. So she sits on the chests of sleepers, and then she tries to strangle them. And that kind of reminded me of the German concept of the Nachtmahr, which is the old German word for nightmare, but it's also a word to describe a demon-like being that sits on people's chests while they sleep and tortures them.
Which is not to be confused with the German word for nightmare, which is Albtraum, which is something
different. Yeah, but yeah, exactly, it's Albtraum. But Nachtmahr and nightmare are kind of two connected, like they have the same etymological root. And Nachtmahr is the old German word for nightmare. But it also is a word for this little kind of gnome kind of figure that sits on people's chests while they sleep. And there is this very famous painting by Johann Heinrich Füssli called Nachtmahr that depicts just that. And there are, I really like that. And there are many versions of that painting. So it's not just one painting. And I think one is in Detroit in a museum, and one is in Frankfurt. And I'm pretty sure that I've seen it one time in the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Wien, but I don't know if that was just if they just lend it from somewhere or if it's there for good. I don't know. But I really like Füssli's depictions of the Nachtmahr, and I'm gonna also add links into the show notes so that you can also look at it. And it's very probable that those ideas, so the Kikimora sitting on people's chests and the Nachtmahr sitting on people's chests, so on the one hand in Russian Slavic folklore and on the other hand in German folklore, those ideas actually stem from the phenomenon of sleep paralysis. And in fact, the Kikimora in Russia was the kind of the first explanation, folkloric explanation for sleep paralysis. And then one thing that Kikimora also does that I don't have an explanation for and I don't understand it. So if any of our listeners knows what this is about, then please tell us. Because the Kikimora is told to spin flax from dusk to dawn. And she does that with bad intentions for humanity. How you can spin flax with bad intentions for humanity, I have no idea. I don't know. So I didn't really understand that part, but maybe one of the listeners knows it and can tell us. And then one figure that's very different from the two Russian figures that I talked about is the Mavka. And that's a Ukrainian, female spirit slash witch figure. And other than the Russian female witches, the Ukrainian Mavka is portrayed as a very beautiful young woman. And she's long haired, she's sometimes naked, and she's a danger to young men. I mean, typical. Yeah. And she entices them and lures them into woods where they... Yeah. Where she... Okay, listen. She entices young men and lures them into woods where she tickles them to death. I mean, first of all, I don't think you use the word tickle correctly. I don't think it means what you think it means. I don't think tickling is what she does. And secondly, if you try to kill someone by tickling them, you're doing it wrong. That's the two things that I have to say to that. Okay. So then, like vampires, the Mavka has no reflection in water, for example, and she doesn't cast a shadow. And interestingly, it's kind of one thing that grosses me out a lot, but I'm going to say nonetheless. She has no back, so she kind of has a hole in her body instead of a back. Yes, exactly. I wish our listeners could see Liz's face right now. It's pretty amazing. That's how I feel about it. Exactly. So she has no back, but basically a hole, and her insides can be seen. To which I have to say, I'm not surprised that she's angry. I mean, I would be pissed if I wouldn't have a back and my insides could be seen. I bet it's not a nice state to be in. All right, so that was the things that I wanted to say about Russian / Ukrainian / Slavic folklore. Now I want to say just a few words on Jenny Greenteeth, which is just, I'm just discussing her because it's a figure that I like. She's from England and she has been a part of English folklore for generations, and she has her roots in antiquity, where she, alongside many other water-related demons, is said to haunt rivers and ponds. And what she does is she drags children and elderly into the water to be devoured. And, but, you know, other than...
Nice.
Yeah. So, and other than all the other, like, water demons, Jenny Greenteeth was said to be particularly horrible and gruesome, gruesome water hag. And she was especially fond of drowning children. And for this reason, parents would tell the children to stay away from the bodies of water. So she was kind of used as a very effective deterrent to youthful curiosity. So she was kind of used as kind of a boogeyman to kind of discipline children, in a sense. And the reason why she's called Jenny Greenteeth is that she has green skin, she has sharp teeth, she has long hair, and she also has different names in different regions. So she's also known as Ginny Greenteeth, Wicked Jenny, and Peg O'Neill. Sometimes her name, Jenny Greenteeth, is also used for pondweed or duckweed. There's this idea that duckweed is... it's very dangerous to young children, and by telling them that this is kind of a river hag that is just manifesting in kind of the form of duckweed, they are kept away from, be kept away from water.
So what time period was Jenny Greenteeth?
Okay, so listen, bad research on my part.
Sorry.
So she comes from, it goes back to antiquity. That's what I found out.
Okay.
But, you know, now she kind of survived in folklore and in kind of, yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So
it's interesting that you have a description, a physical description of her, because the witch that I'm going to talk about was invisible.
That witch, I love it. Okay, sorry. I love it.
I'm going to talk about the Bell Witch.
Yes.
Perhaps you have heard of her. She's arguably the most famous witch in American folklore. The Bell Witch haunting occurred in Tennessee after the family of John Bell moved there from their previous home in North Carolina. And this was the early 1800s. It lasted about 4 years, this whole witch thing, between 1817 to 1821. So that's 4 years of horrible things happening to this family. And there are plenty of books about this haunting. And although I'm not going to have the chance to dive into too many details on the podcast, I think it's worth a little extra time on your end, listeners, to read a bit on it, because it's just really fascinating and actually really creepy. So here's how it started. There was a dog that John Bell saw out in the field, but it wasn't an ordinary dog. It was a dog with the head of a rabbit. He tried to shoot at this dog, and I think it just disappeared. He didn't hit it, but apparently that was enough to piss it off and basically sign his death certificate, because after that, all kinds of crazy things started happening to his house and his family. So I think we're in the shape-shifting witches here is the whole idea of that. But at first there were sounds of something beating on the outside of the house, like knockings, and they would go to inspect it, but they couldn't find anything outside that was making the noise. Then his family started hearing scratching, gnawing, knockings from inside the house. And then it escalated to family members getting physically assaulted and there actually being visible marks left on their skin from being kicked, scratched, beaten by this unseen apparition.
So a lot of that actually sounds like typical tales of poltergeist hauntings more than mm-hmm. witches' stories. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. The physical assaults were concentrated, it seemed, on John Bell's daughter, Elizabeth Bell, who they called Betsy. I think she was around high school age when this had started. I could be wrong, though. But Betsy frequently had visible marks on her face, like her cheeks would get red from being slapped. She might have marks on her body. Eventually, this got to a point where John Bell asked his friend to come over to check out what was plaguing the household, see if he could figure out what the problem was, since they couldn't see anything again. And the neighbor's name was James Johnston, and I think he brought his wife with him, but he came over to spend the night, and he eventually, I think he said something like things were happening and he demanded that the witch reveal who she was. And at that point, these whisperings that they had heard before started to become very clear, and they could hear a voice, disembodied voice, very clearly, as if this whole thing had upset her even more. And this whole thing became famous. There were people that would stop by so that they could hear the witch talking or see things happen. And at one point, General Andrew Jackson even stopped by. He also believed that something was there. And those who came by were not disappointed. They were terrified, maybe, but not disappointed, because they would also be attacked and they would hear the noises and they would hear the voice or the laughing or whatever. And the witch, they say, got the nickname of Kate because when, again, they were interrogating her, she apparently claimed at one point to have been summoned by John Bell's neighbor, who was a woman named Kate. And Kate supposedly was, I think, a business rival or something of his. And I believe she actually, when word circulated that the witch claimed to have come from her, she got very upset and said, "You need to recant that because I don't know what you're talking about." But anyway, they called the witch Kate after that. She began afflicting John with a horrible illness. He would be forced to go without eating for long periods of time. He wouldn't be able to talk. His tongue would swell up. He started to have like tics and seizures. His body began to fail him, and doctors had no answers for what was happening or how to alleviate his pains. Eventually, he was bedridden, and the witch, they say, would taunt him incessantly. Again, invisibly, but he could hear her. and apparently others could too. She would be laughing, cursing, prodding him while he was helpless, and eventually he fell into a sleep and he never woke.
Right.
The morning that his family discovered that he was not doing well, like actually was not waking from his sleep, they went to the cupboard to get his medicine because they had some medicine they were trying to give him to help. And in his medicine cabinet, there were no medicines, I guess. There was this mysterious bottle that contained a dark liquid, and some of it was...
Okay.
Yeah, some of it was missing, and I think that they could see there was a little bit of liquid left in his mouth. I'm not sure. So apparently he drank this, consumed this liquid somehow. No one knew what it was or how it got there, but they said, well, let's just test it on the cat.
Don't do that.
Not the cat.
Yeah. Yeah, well, apparently the cat died right away.
Of course.
Oh, the poor baby. I don't want this to... No. I'm gonna cry.
And apparently John Bell died shortly after this.
So I don't care about people dying, but the cat is really breaking
my heart. The poor kitty. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
But he died shortly after consuming this. Apparently upon his death, the witch is said to have laughed and taken credit for his death. And she said about the liquid, I gave old Jack a big dose of that last night, which fixed him.
Okay.
And she also made sure to be present at his funeral, laughing and cheering that he was finally dead.
So she only manifests as like a disembodied voice, right? Just the only way you can kind of come across her. She's never seen or anything.
Right. I mean, I wasn't finding anything on any visible pictures of her or anybody talking about how she was physically described. It was just discussing a disembodied voice.
Yeah. Why did anyone come up with the idea that it's a witch? Like, why didn't they say this house is haunted or something?
I'm not sure if it's because she said that, of course, the whole idea that she was summoned would indicate that she wasn't a witch.
Yeah. It's so weird because none of this...
Maybe because of the dog.
None of this sounds like a witch story. Like,
yeah, I know. It does sound like a poltergeist type thing or a demon or something. But you would think that the torture of the family would stop as soon as John died because that seemed to be her, you know, what she was really excited about. But she didn't leave the family alone until she made sure that Betsy's life was miserable enough that she couldn't marry the love of her life. apparently, Betsy really liked this boy. I can't remember his name, but the witch would show up all the time and threaten them that they couldn't be together or she would throw rocks at them or whatever. And eventually it got to a point where Betsy figured that if she continued the relationship, even though they were engaged, but if they continued the relationship, that perhaps the witch would afflict her fiancé as well, like it did her father, and she didn't want him to die. So she called off the engagement. Then the witch told Betsy's mother, the widow of John Bell, that she was done for now, and she would leave the family alone for 7 years, but she would be back.
Mm.
And she did come back and spoke with John's son, John Jr., apparently giving him predictions of the future. She was around for, the stories are conflicting, but 2 to 3 weeks, and then disappeared again, and she vowed that she would come back to visit descendants later on. I couldn't find too much on that. Of course, it may be in some of the books, the extensive books that have done a lot of research, but maybe, just maybe, you know, she's still around today.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes, dun, dun, dun.
So this is not related to that per se, but the, like, summoning thing totally reminded me of Bloody Mary.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do we all know what Bloody Mary is?
We do, but you can explain it. You can explain it. Yeah.
Yeah, so it originally was this thing where young women would walk up a flight of stairs backward holding a candle in their hand and a mirror in a darkened house, and they would look in the mirror and they were supposed to see the view of their future husband's face.
Yeah.
And then that, like, sometimes they would not see their future husband, they would see like a skull or a grim reaper saying that they were destined to die before they have a chance to marry, which is like, I'm sorry, lady, you're going to die an old maid.
Well, I wouldn't mind that. I prefer dying an old maid than being married, so.
Sure. But yeah, so, but then the other Bloody Mary thing, it's usually on Halloween, you like look into the mirror, say Bloody Mary 3 times with like a dimly lit, like a candle or really dimly lit room, and like Bloody Mary is supposed to appear, and it's supposed to like curse at you, strangle you, steal your soul, drink your blood, you know, steal your penis.
You know, we tried that. When I was in elementary school, a group of friends and I went into the girls' bathroom and shut the lights off because it was like an overcast day, and we held hands and we said her name
and
nothing happened.
Surprisingly.
Maybe she doesn't visit schools.
Maybe.
Maybe, but, you know, as I said last time, the podcast Feminist Focal has a really cool episode on Bloody Mary, so you can listen
Oh, nice.
To everything about it. And there, I think it's in this podcast where they also say that when they are, when you stand in front of a mirror and it's dark in the room, then it's more likely that you see other things in a mirror than there actually are. So it's kind of...
Sure.
Yeah, so...
Anyway, the summoning thing just reminded me of Bloody Mary.
That's cool. So yeah, so that's it for the American witch or poltergeist or demon or whatever in the world the Bell Witch was or is. And I know we talked about Japanese folklore a little bit in the last episode.
Particularly about the cat witch.
Yes.
And the foxes.
Yes, the fox witches and the cat witch.
We're afraid of the cat witch, so... We have to mention her first.
Right, yes. But I wanted to cover a couple specific ones in this episode as well. And the first thing I have to do is give a shout out to my good friend, Tiffany. She helped me with this section immensely, as this is one of her areas of interest and expertise. So thank you, Tiffany.
Thank you, Tiffany.
Yeah, so she suggested a few different female characters that I guess... we might categorize more demon-like than witch-like, but I think that that kind of goes along with everything else that we've talked about in the last few episodes.
That, you know, there are very unclear boundaries, I think, so it just seems to be, you know, it's sometimes very difficult to keep those apart in, like, all of the stories we basically told in all of our witches episodes, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, anyway, there's a what's called a NOH, no play, in Japan called the Fields of Adachi. The story actually sounds really similar to what we talked about earlier with Baba Yaga. So there's this scenario where there are some Buddhist monks who are headed to a temple, but they get lost on their way there due to the weather. They're up in the mountains, it's snowy. They wander up to a single hut that is the only respite that they can find. And inside this hut is a lonely widowed woman just spinning thread.
Because what else would you do? Like, what else would you do? As a woman in a hut... You spin thread, that's what happens.
Yeah, she allows them to enter her home, but only after some initial protests because she felt that her humble abode was beneath them. But she eventually lets them in, and once inside, and they're comfortable, she steps out for a moment. I can't remember why, but she steps out, and she asks that they not look into a particular room that is behind a closed door.
Oh my god, this is like Bluebeard and every other thing with, like, women, like, don't go, here's the key, but don't open the doors.
Yeah, right. So naturally, you know, as you could guess, one of the monks doesn't listen and opens the door. And inside is a room full of skeletons that reaches from floor to the ceiling.
That's quite impressive.
He wakes everybody up. And they then realize that, oh my gosh, we are accidentally in the home of Adachi and we need to get out of here. So they try to leave. However, as they are leaving, the demoness comes back, but in her natural form. So she's not the little old lady anymore. She is a demon with wild red hair, a monstrous face, and two horns jutting out of her head.
Of course, wow. Red hair, Beatrice.
Of course.
The priests are able to defeat her, and by defeat her, I mean they get her to leave them alone. They don't kill her or anything, but they cause her to flee back to the mountains with the power of prayer. This is a play that depicts one of three ogresses, or she-demon, which are popular in stories of Japan, so apparently she's one of three. I am not sure what the other ones are, but I am going to provide a link, so you can look into that some more. And then another story that Tiffany related to me is one of a woman scorned. It is called The Black Hair. So we have a poor woman who incidentally has beautiful long black hair, and her husband were struggling financially. She spun yarn to try to make ends meet, but apparently it just wasn't enough for him. So he left for a wealthier woman. But he soon realized that he had made a huge mistake and tried to return to his first wife. Upon his return, she is dutifully working, you know, spinning yarn, as you do.
Yeah, of course, as you do in your hut.
Yes. And this also reminds me of, you know, the idea of proper feminine virtue from ancient Rome. And I'm sure that a lot of other places, obviously. But yeah, the whole story of different women in ancient Rome sitting at home rather than out partying, spinning wool. Anyway, neither here nor there. But so she's still sitting there working, and she looks beautiful as ever with her long, silky black hair that he just loves to touch.
Oh, creepy. God.
And she appears to forgive him.
Oh, fuck him.
They embrace. They go to bed for the night.
Okay.
But in the morning, when he rolls over to see his beloved, he finds instead a skeleton with long black locks, and realizes that he is in a house that is crumbling around him. He panics because this is not what he went to sleep with. And as I suppose anyone would that just committed necrophilia.
I mean, there are people who commit necrophilia intentionally. So true. I would say right.
Unknowingly. I should say unknowingly committed necrophilia. But before he has a chance to do anything, the skeleton dissolves away.
I mean, it serves him right, I think. So
the only thing that's left is the hair, which starts to move
yes.
toward him
yes.
and attack him. He tries to run, but the hair is wrapped around him and begins to suck his life out of him. Literally, he starts to age as he's fighting toward the door until right as he gets to it, his body turns to a skeleton. And that's how the story ends.
That is amazing.
He got what he deserved.
Yes, I love that.
Yes. I thought you might like that one.
Yes, I do.
And then there's another one that I found while digging around a little bit. Tiffany didn't relate this one, but I saw it when I was trying to look up a few more details, and I thought that it was interesting and worth mentioning. It's about a two-mouthed woman, which I had never heard this story, so I thought it was pretty neat. But there are two different forms of this urban legend, but the idea is that there's a woman called a Furukuchi Onna.
All right.
Who is, like I said a second ago, a woman with two mouths.
I have a very infantile joke about the two mouths that I'm not going to make now, so go ahead.
Okay. But one mouth is a regular mouth that looks like normal, placed on the front of the head where it should be. The other mouth, though, is insatiable, and it's hidden in the back of the woman's head beneath her hair.
Again, the hair.
Yeah, her skull will actually split apart to accommodate her mouth. Anyway, in one depiction of this woman, which I'm guessing is kind of the origin myth as to how this two-mouthed woman came about, we are told that a single father, a widower, remarried a woman who was not the nicest individual, and together they had a child. So now he has two children. She has one.
Okay.
Times got tough, and the new wife had to choose which child to feed, hers that she gave birth to or her stepdaughter from his previous marriage. She chose her own, and his oldest daughter died of starvation. A while later, there was a minor accident, you could say, that entailed him accidentally hitting his wife in the back of the head with an axe.
Oh, yeah. It always happens by accident. Yeah. I mean, it just sometimes happens.
Yeah. Apparently, it was a total accident.
Yeah, of course.
She obviously nearly died, but managed to pull through.
Badass.
Instead of the wound healing, though, it turned into a gaping mouth with teeth and a tongue. And it whispered to the husband while in bed one night that she was cursed because she caused his daughter to starve to death.
Oh.
So, yeah, there are other depictions of the two-mouthed woman who attempts to murder those who find out her secret, because this is a secret later on. Mm-hmm. That's why I think that first one is like the origin myth. But I just thought it was interesting because I can't recall that in any myths that I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Over the years.
Yeah.
That seems to be... is at least in my very limited scope yeah. of knowledge on this, the only one that I'm aware of.
I love those stories.
Absolutely.
They are great. Both of them. So, really amazing. I really love them.
So, cool. My stories, I have a follow-up on our raven mocker, raven imitator spirit from the Native American thing. And then I have a couple of stories of real-life, not folklore, witches in South America. So, Colombia and Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
Bad shit happens in Brazil, by the way. Anyway.
Oh.
I am so excited about the raven mocker because I was curious after the last episode.
Okay, yeah. So, the raven mocker... from the Cherokee tradition, it's not just a single witch, it's a type of witch, basically. And so they are considered the worst of all evil spirits. Think of them as the angel of death.
Oh.
Because of this, there's a point person to like deal with these type of attacks. But they're witch in kind of a European term, but not really like witches per se. You know, they're just evil,
yeah.
evil magic users, basically. They can be equally men or women. They can look like a person or take the form of an animal. They usually come to a house at night when a person is sick, stomp on the roof, beat on the sides of the house, knock the person out of the bed, drag them on the floor, and they try to hasten the person's death.
All right.
Oh, wow.
So they want the sick person to die faster and not use up any of their lifespan so that they can take the unused lifetime and add it to their own.
That's practical.
Oh. So do they target normally younger people then?
Not usually.
That's stupid.
Because they want people that are easy to kill, so they get people who are sick.
So you rather kill many like old sick people instead of one young person?
Yes.
Not a very economical
use. No, it's not. Not at all.
You know, energy. But go ahead.
Not at all. But if there was a young sick person, they would be all over that too.
Sure they would.
So they imitate the sound of a diving raven when they arrive, which is why they're called the Raven Mocker.
Uh-huh.
And then all other evil spirits tend to flee the home when they show up because they are so badass.
Mm-hmm.
And then they try to steal the heart of the sick person without leaving a mark, and then they eat the heart.
Ugh, yeah.
Yeah, and then so it adds years to their own life. They're usually invisible. Imagine how, like, terrifying it might be to have, like, an already deathly sick person and then be worried about this other thing that's coming to get you because you're already ill and close to dying, and they just want to hasten that along so they can suck your life force.
Well, sure, and depending on where you live, ravens are very common in North America.
Yeah.
And so you're hearing these ravens, like, swooping, and you're like, holy crap, it's coming for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of vampires being portrayed as bats.
Yeah, absolutely. So the family typically summons a medicine person. They say, you know, often people say medicine man, but it could be equally a man or a woman, to keep watch and hold it at bay while the person recovers. If the person dies, the medicine person, the, like, healer will keep watch until the person is buried, and after burial the heart can't be taken. So they're trying to preserve the heart to make sure that the Raven Mocker does not get it.
Wow.
So they're usually invisible while they're feeding, and only those with strong medicine connections and connections with the spirit world can spot them and cause them to die within 7 days.
Okay.
So yeah, that is the Raven Mocker. Raven Mockers appear in a couple of different books in Mountain Monsters. It kind of comes in the form of a Bigfoot, a raven, oh, wow, a wolf, a little girl, and a hag called the Woman of the Woods.
Whoa. How in the world is it supposed to be invisible if it's in the form of Bigfoot? Like,
no idea.
How do you...
No idea. It's a thing.
Interesting.
Like, I think when they're feeding, they're invisible, but you can see them other times, like...
Oh, so then they would have thought that if they saw, like, a Bigfoot that, oh my goodness, somebody's about to get their heart stolen?
Exactly.
Huh.
Yes.
That's cool. Kind of.
Or maybe not.
Yeah. So the other witches I'm going to put those in quotes because they're really like healers that were punished by typically Catholic priests, either during the Inquisition or missionary priests in Colombia and Brazil.
Oh, the Catholic Church did so much good in the world.
Yes. So we've talked a lot about how a lot of witches were really just women who were very skilled in medicine, both in the European tradition as well as in kind of First People traditions and others. So in Colombia, obviously, there were a lot of Afro-Caribbean women who were part of the culture there. You get this in a lot of in different countries in South America. You have different compositions of the population. Some of them have more Afro-Caribbean individuals. Some of them have more kind of indigenous communities. But in Colombia, records show that the Inquisition sentenced Afro-Caribbean women to the stake and other penalties, probably disproportionately, particularly in these areas. So in 1632, Elena de Vitoria and other Africans were victimized by a witch craze in Cartagena, Colombia. One of them escaped burning because of her great skill in medicine and healing. And her death sentence was revoked, and she was brought out to do public penance. So they call it an auto de fe, probably. And it's basically an act of faith, which is a ritual of public penance of condemned heretics that took place during the Spanish Inquisition. She received 200 lashes, the same penalty imposed on pagans and sorcerers in early medieval Europe, and a sentence of life in prison. But because her medical skills were so great, she only ended up serving 6 years. I'm sure she still got the 200 lashes, but she only ended up serving 6 years, which is pretty awesome, actually, in the scheme of things, right?
Yeah.
and she enjoyed a high reputation as a physician, as well, was allowed to leave prison and practice her profession. And she even had inquisitors and bishops among her patients. And she earned so much money and was charitable in relieving the necessities of her, like, fellow prisoners. So she helped her fellow prisoners when she was in jail with their ailments. And she, even though the Spanish Catholics persecuted her, she still was kind enough to help them with their medical maladies.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
That's a true healer, right? Honest to her craft.
Yeah.
Right. But we also had a lot of... African witches who were punished, mestiza witches. Ana de Avila, a mestiza widow, escaped the whipping of punishment, public punishment, but she had already been severely tortured and was fined 1,000 pesos because of her, you know, sorcery.
Oh, God.
And then we have Ana Beltran, who had been tortured to death, and so she could not actually appear in a public ceremony, but... The judges read out a sentence of absolution for her, even though she couldn't do the public ceremony of being, like, contrition for her sins as a sorcerer.
Oh, nice.
So,
yeah,
Colombia. That was Colombia. In Brazil, though, we have actually women who were particularly in the late 1600s and in the 1700s, women who were actually... part of these kind of witch hunt craze that were punished and either, yeah, I mean, there were witch trials there. There's a very interesting cultural mix in colonial Brazil. So there were West African, Tupi and other Indian nations, a Jewish and Moorish, as well as Catholic Portuguese. Many in this last category had been exiled to Brazil for practicing witchcraft or other heresies. So they're like, get the hell out of, of Portugal. Go to Brazil. We don't want you here.
Oh, God.
So they added pagan European customs to the blend of the other kind of native traditional religions that were there. So now you have a combination of Christian, well, what we think of as Western European customs mm-hmm. to native customs as well. So a sizable number of old Christians were actually, like, incompletely Christianized. So they didn't actually know Catholic doctrine. They didn't know what the Trinity was. They didn't know basic prayers, which was totally fine by them because they didn't actually want to be Christian anyway.
Yeah.
So often they were skeptics who scoffed at the church. They punished statues of the saints, the Virgin, or Jesus when bad things happened to them. And Brazilians performed Jewish and Moorish and gypsy dances as, like, a form of ritual as well. So the authorities complained that they danced in the form of conga lines during religious celebrations, like Catholic religious celebrations, when they, like, colonized Brazil.
Okay.
But when the inquisitorial visitations began in the late 1500s, many Muslim and Jewish and kind of new Christians were forced to appear before the tribunals, and gypsy women... And by gypsy, I mean kind of a Roma people, but I don't know that ethnically they are related to the Roma, and the source material says gypsy, so that's what I'm going to go with, understanding that that term is problematic. So a gypsy woman was interrogated for denying that there was a day of judgment.
Jesus.
Brazilians lived in panic of these kind of conquests. So a famous witch, Maria Goncalves, was tried in 1591. She had defied institutional church authority, saying that, quote, if a bishop had a mitre, she also had a mitre. And if the bishop preached from the pulpit, then she also preached from the cadeira, which is a great chair from which priestesses presided over ceremonies. So she's kind of like, if you can do that, I can do my thing.
She's cool.
Yeah, she's pretty awesome. And much of her practice concerned sexual matters, such as curing impotence and sterility.
Oh.
She made powders from the herbs she gathered in the forest and was accused of feeding the devil from a wound in her foot.
Of course. What else would you do with a wound in your foot? I mean...
Of course. She was denounced to the Inquisition and soon arrested as a witch after being reported by an ex-lover.
Oh, jeez. Come on.
Fuck that guy.
Absurd.
Also, what happened to her then?
I'm pretty sure she was... I couldn't find any additional information about, like, what happened to her. I'm pretty sure if history is any indicator, she was forced to, like, recant and publicly flogged and tortured.
Right. Oh, nice.
Wow.
Let's be honest. It's the Inquisition.
God.
So we have, in 1692, she died in Sao Paulo. In 1692, we have Mima Renard. and she was an alleged Brazilian witch. It's perhaps the most famed Brazilian witch trial in Sao Paulo. She immigrated from France to the Portuguese colony of Brazil with her spouse, René Renard, and settled in Sao Paulo.
Mm-hmm.
She was beautiful, attracted great sexual attention from men, and eventually her spouse was murdered by one of the men who was in love with her.
Like, come on. It's...
I know.
What's up with that, guys?
I know. And then because she's a woman in the, like, late 1600s, she had no money.
Of course.
So she was then destitute after her husband was killed. Not that the dude who killed her husband, like, took care of her or anything.
No, why should he?
And so she was forced to turn to prostitution to support herself.
Oh, God.
So women in the city accused her of enchanting her clients with magic.
Really?
Yeah. And when two of her married clients started fighting, they got into a fight. Two dudes were married, not a woman and man who were married.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just thought, why in the world is she turning on her if she was also visiting her? This doesn't make any sense.
No. Two dudes who were married, who were probably, you know, they're enchanted. They don't know what they're doing. They're fighting over her.
They had no control over themselves because of her. They would have never done this otherwise.
Exactly. It was her fault.
Yeah.
Of course. Anyway, during this fight, one of them murdered the other one.
Oh, nice. It's all her fault.
And the wives of these clients reported her to the parish priest for having enchanted the men by use of witchcraft.
The fuck?
Now, what do we think happened to her?
She died.
Maybe she was executed.
Yes, she was judged guilty and charged and executed by public burning.
I mean, she deserved it, to be honest. She... I mean...
What?
Enchanting men by the use of witchcraft. Seriously. No, I'm of course joking. It's ridiculous.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous.
So, Ursulina de Jesus died in 1754. She was also an alleged Brazilian witch.
Mm-hmm.
She was married to Sebastiano de Jesus in Sao Paulo. Her husband had a position of importance in the city, which meant that he was, like, in the public eye. She was accused of witchcraft by her husband, who claimed that she had prevented him from having children by making him sterile by using magic.
Seriously, I mean, it's always those guys in Brazil.
Did he ever end up having children?
Good question. I don't know. At the time, he was having an affair with his mistress, Cesara,
of course,
who confirmed that he was sterile. So she didn't have kids either. Now, let's...
I mean, if he had sex with other women and didn't have children, then it's probably because those women were witches too, right? That's the only explanation.
Maybe he had sex with so many random women that he had some sort of venereal disease that caused him to be impotent. I don't know.
What? I don't think that's the case. I think they're just all wishes.
Those diseases sound like spells that could be put upon a man.
Yeah.
Clearly. So she was sentenced guilty of heresy by having used witchcraft and was executed by burning in public.
Of course.
Wow. I feel like we're kind of back to... the way Beatrice started the last episode here, where we should have had a warning.
Yes.
That things were about to go really, really south.
Really bad.
Yeah. So there were a lot of healing rituals that were done and described as expulsions of sorceries by Catholic priests in Brazil. In Minas, which is another city in Brazil, in 1763, the free black Domingos Marinhos told authorities that he went to a healer, Maria Cardosa, for treatment of various illnesses. She and her 16-year-old godson, Antonio, said prayers over him in their tongue, which meant that they weren't using Portuguese. They were using a native language, indigenous language, which that's a big no-no.
Yeah, that's absolutely a no-no.
They have not assimilated.
They ran... No, not assimilated, totally practicing traditional religions. They ran a stone along his body and then a razor fastened to a ball of yarn. And the inquisitors accused this other person of dealing with the devil. She cured trembling with white and red and black roses and prayers. They ridiculed them, the healing methods, and forced them to, like, get rid of their healing methods. So there were all of these women who were performing these kind of healing rituals, and people were going to them for these healing rituals. And then when questioned by local, like, religious authorities, they were like, oh, I didn't know what happened. They were using this weird language, and then bad things happened to them.
They just give them up.
Absolutely.
Oh, God.
So then there was a Portuguese woman, Ludovina Ferreira. She learned to do, she was actually Portuguese, and she learned to do magical cures from the Indians, from the native peoples in Brazil, which is great. Like, very open to it. She was an apprentice to a local healer named Antonia around 1735. She's described as chanting songs in a native language and blowing smoke on a patient from an herbal cigar.
Okay.
The patient completely recovered, which, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
And then another European, Maria Joana, learned prayers from the Indians, sometimes adapting Portuguese formulas to them. So using kind of both a mix of the two. A native woman, Luisa Sebastiana, taught her an Indian chant with blowing and spitting and charms. And Maria Joana also learned love magic, how to make like a rinse with herbs and then repeat the charm at the crossroads at midnight.
The
crossroads again.
Yeah. Certain insect and smoke her genitals with this resin.
All right.
And then the leaves of various trees would attract men, mixing them with tobacco. She gave them to people to like to attract men. And the witchcraft really served her well. When the man she lived with brought another woman into her house as a lover, she gave him a drink that put a stop to that. So she was able to both induce the love as well as stop that. So one would have said she was also a witch.
Yeah, and she didn't put a stop to it by giving him something that he died from.
No.
Because that's the one thing that I
probably just something that made him impotent, which just goes back to the woman who was burned at the stake.
Right.
And then the last one is the Brazilian witch Maria da Conceição. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. She was active as what they describe as a cunning woman.
Mm-hmm.
She was known for her great knowledge of medicinal herbs, which she used to manufacture medicines for use in her work as an herbalist physician. She eventually came in conflict with a priest, Father Luis, who was opposed to herbal medicine, keeping the woman down.
All right.
So Father Luis accused her of heresy and witchcraft, and she was put on trial in accordance with Portuguese law against witchcraft. And she was guilty as charged and executed by burning.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So there you go. Brazil in the 1700s, well, basically from like the 1500s to the 1700s was not a welcoming place of women who were herbalists. And
it doesn't sound like it.
They had witch trials of their own.
This sounds a lot like Europe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because especially Portugal, because they are very much and Colombia, they had a lot of Spanish and Portuguese influence. So it makes sense that Brazil and Colombia would have had this same connection with the witch trials in Europe. But these are, you know, women known to be witches in these areas who were basically just herbalist healers and bad shit happens.
Oh, yeah. I mean, white Europeans just fucked up everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we still have problems because of that. So thanks. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. So that's kind of the moral of the story, why Europeans fuck up everything. I mean, I'm kind of speechless now because I'm really impressed about all of that.
I'm sorry.
Well, let's go back to if you see Bigfoot.
If you see Bigfoot, it might be coming for your heart if you're sick.
Yours or someone that you know who's ill, so.
Right.
That's interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and it's very, I mean, it happens a lot that people see Bigfoot, you know, because it's like one of the most common animals in Europe and America. Yeah. So
there's sightings all over.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing we need to worry about is sweet little old ladies who are probably trying to eat us.
That's the main thing you have to be scared about. Yeah. Especially if you're a man.
Oh, yes. If you're traveling alone, do not go into a hut. And if it has chicken legs.
But the thing is, you have to be, if you're a man, you have to be scared of old ladies who are ugly. and have long noses, but you also have to be very afraid.
And attractive women who might have fox-like features from our previous episode.
And also attractive women who are naked and attractive women who have holes in the backs. So.
Yeah, or you should be afraid of a woman that you left and come back to because she's not going to have you.
You have to be afraid of all women.
Or if you are not able to have children, blame the woman.
Don't ever try to shoot at a dog with a rabbit's head. That's the bad news.
Exactly. That's our... We have so many lessons. We have so many lessons.
And don't ever sleep with a dead woman because she's going to turn you into bones. And kill you too.
So. Yeah. Her hair will do it. She'll take you. This is a podcast about, morals to stories.
Yeah.
It's really.
Real life advice and strategies and how to get through your daily life. This is what we learn from us. All right. So you can listen to us on our homepage, shewhopersisted.com. You can write us an email, shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com. You can also listen to us on iTunes. And please, if you like this podcast, then please rate and review us.
Yes.
I know I've said it 100 times, but this is how other people find us. And we all need more nasty in our lives, right, Heather?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, like you can listen to us everywhere. You can listen to podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, anywhere. Our Twitter is shepersistedpod. We have a Facebook page and a Facebook group where you can discuss things with us. And we have an Instagram account. And that's it. And we hope that you enjoyed this episode. And until next time, stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Bye.